the one thing I say about my work on the anxious achiever is that we come from a strengths-based perspective. And this is what I've learned in my work in issue advocacy. I did a lot of work in education policy and early childhood education, and actually with ACEs, adverse childhood events, which is a way of helping people manage trauma and identify how trauma has impacted them and how to get help. We have to approach whatever makes us different from a strengths-based perspective. We may not feel, when I'm depressed, I don't feel strong. I don't feel like this is a benefit to me. I can't be like, oh, what a happy story, I have depression. So great, I'm so strong. But there is important resiliency that you can build over time with help and with the work. And I think that it's really important. So, you know, that's why I talk about anxiety in leadership as something that can build tremendous leadership strengths.
Hey! It's finally here. Welcome to Do It With Dan. Entrepreneurial philanthropist, public speaker and author, creator of the Beyond Intention Paradigm. Here is your host, Daniel Mengena.
Hello, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dan Mengena. Very, very excited to meet my guest today. As you guys know, I don't like to do any research at all before I meet people. And if I know the person already, I'm generally speaking to them about something that I don't know anything about. So I'm very excited to get to know my guest, find out all about her book and all of the things. So without further ado, would you like to introduce yourself and let the people know who you are and what it is you do?
Sure. I'm Maura Ahrens-Mealy. I live outside Boston, Massachusetts. I was a political consultant for many years. I worked at the intersection of digital marketing and communications and politics and social change. I worked for the Democratic Party in the US and for several presidential candidates. And then I ran my own business doing that kind of work around issue advocacy and political communication, mostly aimed at mobilizing women. I sold that business in 2021 and am really now devoting my life to my true passion, which is mental health at work. I am someone who has struggled and managed my mental health since I was a teenager. It's been a huge part of my life and a huge part of my work.
Awesome. So. Knew you were going to be a good one. Just knew it. So I do want to get into the story, but whenever I meet people from north of the border, I've lived primarily in Mexico since 2018. Whenever I meet people from north of the border, I'm always really interested to know what your experience is of the way that politics works in the US versus other parts of the world. Obviously, being from the UK, born and raised, our politics is very different. I've spent a lot of time in Africa, where my parents are from, different parts of Africa, and seeing the way the politics works there in different parts of Asia. And it's really fascinating to see how politics works in different parts of the world. Have you ever sat with the way that politics works differently in the US to different parts of the world?
Oh, I mean, I'm obsessed with it. I think
hello.
I mean, my specialty when I ran my business, which was called Women Online, was talking about really hard things in a way that created productive discourse and behavior change, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, without making this an hour-long diatribe on why America is so broken, America is broken, I think, now. I feel that this country is broken. I'm not alone in that. And I feel like a lot of chickens are coming home to roost in terms of how politics has reshaped this country and actually how politics has shaped this country from its very beginning, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult right now. You know, there are conversations in this country that you literally can't have. You can't talk about vaccines for your kids, for example, on most parenting communities and message boards because it is deemed too polarizing and too toxic. And that doesn't happen in other parts of the world. So I think that it's a really difficult time to be an American. And I think that the way we communicate, not just the way we do politics in this country and legislation, the way we talk about it has to profoundly change.
Thank you. And the reason why I'd kind of sort of gone over there to come back to what we're really here to talk about today is because I wonder how easy it is to maintain sound health of the mind when there are so many narratives that are so deeply polarizing that people have to deal with every day. Political correctness, political incorrectness, opinionation, people calling things fact when it's not really necessarily fact, all of this noise. I just wonder how much that contributes, in your opinion, to perhaps the challenges that are being seen across the board, not just in the workplace, but in the education system and in the home in the US.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, you just look at the statistics, you know, 90% of Americans think that we're in a mental health crisis. Mm-hmm. And our institutions don't feel safe or healthy anymore. Our schooling, mm-hmm. work has become part of sort of the stress and sense of existential crisis in this country. So I think it's really hard. And I think that social media and digital media obviously not only spreads disinformation and misinformation, but the speed and the sheer volume of communication isn't mentally healthy for us, right? So we're left trying to process a lot of really scary news. We're left processing all the challenges in our daily life, our internal mental health, and then we never ever get to turn off, and we're living online. We're performing online all the time. So I do feel like it's a little bit of a toxic brew, and nobody really seems to know the answer on how to fix it.
So I'm just really glad that there are voices out there. I can't remember who I was speaking to the other day. I don't think it was on a podcast. I think it was just a conversation I was having with someone, that one in five people in the US now are considered to have some kind of mental health challenge of a sort, with growing numbers. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was the general population or it was a particular group.
It's more still, like one in four.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, okay. Well, there we are. And I was just like, how can a society function? And I mean, so my son's two. He's based out of Mexico at the moment, but his mum is an American citizen, and his primary passport is an American passport. And we've had conversations about where he will grow up, and I've been very concerned about the prospect about that being in many countries, one of which is the US, and that's really just because there is just so much noise. We can't just live nowadays. We can't just go to work. We can't just go to school. We can't just be a part of our social club or whatever. There's all of these minefields. And so I'm just glad, and I'm grateful that you're out here doing the good work to support people with that. And I'm really excited to find out about what you're doing with that.
Thanks. I just want to say one thing, which is that I think one of the things we're trying to wrestle with in America, as more and more data is coming out about young people's mental health, right, Gen Z and mental health and how poor it is this sense of that generation is so messed up. And I sort of want to push back against that argument because, I don't pretend to believe that living in colonial America or in the Industrial Revolution in Britain or during World War I or II, right, was any worse than it is now. I think that there is a sense now that we talk about this stuff more, which is good. And, I think we do risk focusing so much attention right now on the plight of mental health, especially among young people in the country, that we sugarcoat past times, or we don't think about the mental health of other generations. And that is dangerous. You know?
I love that. I love that. And that's actually what I was actually going to first and foremost, you know, ask you. It's, yes, there are conversations we're having about mental health now. So, for example, I'm on the autistic spectrum. I have Asperger's. And I wasn't diagnosed until I was 27 years old. And for many, many years, it was just, I'm a bit quirky. I'm a bit, little bit strange. And there's some downside to having to deal with me. And that was kind of what it was. Until I did, you know, get diagnosed and I was able to get support. And so I can much better manage now being a neurodiverse person in a neurotypical world. And yet, if I go back to my parents' generation, I don't think they were classifying people as being on the spectrum as much as they are today. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on over-labeling and maybe labels showing up in places where they don't necessarily need to be. And does that have an impact on mental health as a whole? Are people being told, oh, this is your thing, you know, this is who you are?
That's really interesting. I have a child who is on the spectrum as well. I think labeling is a really personal thing. I think for some people, myself included, I have bipolar disorder. I think that it's very helpful. It can give you a framework for things that didn't make sense. It can help you get treatment. It can help you get the medications you need. It can help you get the therapies you need. It can help you figure out how to work in the way that you need. So I think that a diagnosis, and then if you want to call that a label, can be life-changing. There's a lot, again, of hand-wringing right now about, there's a big op-ed about it in the New York Times today. You know, younger people are diagnosing themselves on TikTok and they're labeling and they're using neurodivergence or mental illness as part of their identity. And is that really serving them? Is that actually going to make us take this stuff less seriously? I don't know the answer to that. I think it's personal. And so if it helps you, go for it. I mean, when you learned that you were on the spectrum, how did you feel?
Best thing for me. Yeah, it was awesome. Absolutely awesome. But I also did have really great support. I didn't self-diagnose. I didn't read a couple of books and say, this is who I am. Yeah. I was in the hands of a very, very, very skilled doctor who supported me through it and helped me find what my strengths were. So immediately it was presented, oh, these are your superpowers versus, oh my God, this is what's wrong with you. It was presented as strengths right off the bat. So I'm really grateful for that.
The one thing I say about my work on the anxious achiever is that we come from a strengths-based perspective. And this is what I've learned in my work in issue advocacy. I did a lot of work in education policy and early childhood education, and actually with ACEs, adverse childhood events, which is a way of helping people manage trauma and identify how trauma has impacted them and how to get help. We have to approach whatever makes us different from a strengths-based perspective. We may not feel, when I'm depressed, I don't feel strong. I don't feel like this is a benefit to me. I can't be like, oh, what a happy story. I have depression. So great. I'm so strong. But there is important resiliency that you can build over time with help and with the work. And I think that it's really important. So, you know, that's why I talk about anxiety in leadership as something that can build tremendous leadership strengths. I'm not saying it's la-di-da.
Amazing, amazing. And so you've taken your personal experience, you've taken personal experience with you, with your own story, which I'd love to get into, and also the experience you've had being in a number of different workplaces, working at quite high pressure environments, I'm sure. Politics was not the least pressureful environment to be in. And it feels like you said it's something that you're very passionate about. It feels like you've come to a place where you've said, okay, I want to take these experiences, I want to take these stories and do something with it. What would you say was your driving intention or a driving intention that you had in taking all of this life experience and putting this book together, which we're going to talk a bit more about now?
It's my second book. So I was a blogger. So when I was working in politics in Washington, D.C., when I was younger, I started blogging about politics and I was a very early blogger. And that changed my life. The idea that I could write online and connect with people back when that was a meaningful discourse, it was very mm-hmm. meaningful. I've always mm-hmm. written. Writing is my outlet. And I've always written about work at some level. From mm-hmm. from my experience in politics, startups, and corporate America, work was very broken. And if you're different, if you have anxiety or a mental illness, or you are neurodivergent, or you're just sensitive, going to work in a high-pressure environment is, it's like going into battle every day sometimes. And mm-hmm. I really wanted to help people. So that was what my writing was always about. And my first book was called Hiding in the Bathroom, How to Get Out There When You'd Rather Stay Home. And it was sort of a guide for people who are introverted or have social anxiety or who are highly sensitive on mm-hmm. how to build that professional network, start mm-hmm. a business, do all these things that all our lives Amazing. People say, you can never eat lunch alone, crush mm-hmm. it. You always have to be out there. I don't know about you, but for someone like me, that's very difficult. So
yeah,
this was meant to
I'll
be.
Pass.
Yeah. Like, what about the rest of us who are super successful, right? And so, mm-hmm. so I talked about my anxiety in that book. And when I would talk about anxiety, people would just light up. I could just tell. People needed to talk about, high performing people needed to talk about how they manage their anxiety.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating for me that anxiety is where you came from, because the thing that actually led to me accidentally getting into a place where I ended up being diagnosed was that my general anxiety, my social anxiety got so crippling that I just couldn't sleep anymore. I couldn't function anymore. And medication didn't help. And so I ended up getting referred to someone who just happened to be a cognitive behavioral therapist that specialized in working with adults with autism. And so she caught the signs right away. Yeah.
Dan, when can you come on my podcast?
We can sort it out. We can sort it out. We can get that done.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And that's, the course of events that clicked into place for that to happen. It's laughable in a beautiful way, you know, that my anxiety actually ended up being the gateway to me actually getting the help that I needed. I love that you're ringing the bell and flying the flag for people who do have these challenges, and yet rather than an identification with these challenges creating a roadblock that says, oh, I can't do because, it's okay, this is what's happening, what do I do now? It's asking a different frame of questions.
We have to, right? Because mm-hmm. because here's the thing. Everyone feels anxiety. Anxiety mm-hmm. is a hugely typical, normal human emotion. And mm-hmm. right now, especially, how could you not be anxious? Mm-hmm. We act out our anxiety on each other at work in really toxic ways. We control each other. Mm-hmm. We micromanage each other. We gatekeep. We are perfectionistic. We mm-hmm. don't ask for help. We don't delegate. We mm-hmm. mansplain. If we just took a minute to understand how anxiety was affecting us, we could also not only ourselves be much happier, but there's a lot of downstream and upstream effects from all this behavior that really mm-hmm. needs to stop, because 84% of Americans say that their work makes their mental health worse.
Mm. So what are some of the things that people facing some kind of challenge in the workplace can start to do to either identify what that challenge is or start to seek the right support to thrive regardless of what's going on with their mental health?
I mean, I think the first step is I don't want people to get to the place where they can't live. It sounds like what you went through was really painful mm. and horrible. And I've been there too. And I don't want people to have to get that bad. You know, mm. I mean, I think that there's so much shame and stigma around this stuff. Most of us don't have a great mental health literacy, right? It's not a piece of our education that we grow up with, and we don't learn how to tune in. And some of us don't even learn how to talk about our feelings. And mm. we think, oh, it's feelings. Oh, feelings. No, feelings are fundamental to how we operate in the world every day. Mm. And so I really want people to sort of get in touch. And we talk about this in the book, like start listening to your body, start identifying, why do I feel this way before my meeting with my boss? Why do I reach for a drink of vodka after I get home when I got that piece of news? Why do I see a news headline and immediately think a catastrophe is going to befall me very soon? Like, start getting in touch, start identifying what's setting off their anxiety, and then most important, how am I reacting? How am I reacting? Because we all react. It's just our brain's way of trying to make us feel better. And sometimes we react with behaviors, and sometimes we react with thoughts, thought traps. I'm bad, I don't deserve this, I'm definitely getting fired, I'm a fraud, I'm lazy, I should be more like him, right? And the truth is, as you know, through therapy, through many different practices, we can interrupt these behaviors and thoughts that really aren't helping us.
Really feels that yours is not just a message of hope, it's what to do with that hope to move forward. That's what, that's kind of the spirit that I'm getting from what you're sharing in the world. I'd love to dive a little bit more into that. And I don't know how much of your own story that you want to share that kind of weaves into how you are supporting people now, but I'd love to sort of dive a bit into the backstory, the origin story of you.
I mean, it's not that interesting. It's I grew up, no, seriously.
Try the other one.
In suburban New Jersey in the 80s, and my parents were divorced, and my father lived in New York, and my mother lived in New Jersey, and they would shuttle me and my sister back and forth, and it was traumatic. And, you know, I just did an episode on my podcast yesterday about codependency with Melody Beatty, who's the famous, she wrote Codependent No More. She's sort of one of the most famous.
Yes, I need to recognize that name.
Authors and self-help people. And, you know, I was codependent with my mom. I repeated that behavior in my jobs with my bosses. You know, I have spent a lifetime, and I've had the good fortune and privilege, because in America, at least, accessing care is expensive and difficult and unjust. I have had the great good fortune of, ever since I was 19 and got my first clinical diagnosis, of being in therapy, of being on medication, and of having the space to try to understand how I act better, get help when I'm in crisis, but also connect the dots. So much of how we show up in our careers goes way back to our childhood.
Transference of behaviors.
You know, and just patterns, honestly, and habits. And, you know, in my book, I talk a lot about perfectionism. And I ask people to think about if they are perfectionistic, if they believe somehow that if they're not the best, if they're not perfect, I'm using air quotes, their self-worth is tied up in that. Like, who said that to them? How did you get this belief? Because it could be a belief that was instilled in you a long time ago that you have been habitually acting out for decades, right? So we're all sort of living out our stories. And I think it's really important for people in the context of their leadership and where they want to go in their careers to bring that mental health lens into it.
And bringing that lens into it can, I feel, give us the pathway to healing things, or even an awareness of the things that we even want to heal. I was having a conversation with someone about this a couple of days ago, that, you know, sometimes we don't really want to deal with something right now. We're not quite ready to deal with it yet, but at least I know it's there to deal with. I know there are dishes in the sink, even if I'm not ready to wash them now. I'm not going in the cupboard wondering what I'm going to eat out of them. Well, where are the plates gone? Well, they're all in the sink, right? But certainly can start the process of healing, which can allow us to have a more fulfilling human experience, to shift what our experiences of life in the workplace, at home, and the other people who are impacted by the byproduct of what we are getting from the workplace and at the home.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, when you're a parent also, right, you have this wake up call of, my behavior obviously doesn't just impact me. And it is so painful sometimes to deal with that, but it is also, I think, some of the most important work we do as human beings.
Love it, love it. If you were to identify any key points in your journey to becoming the you that you are today, whether it's challenges that you overcame, insights that you had, maybe, you know, a person or a thing that happened, are there any that kind of come to mind as ones that were really supportive of you having a more thriving experience in the face of mental health?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it all sort of came to a crucible when I was 30. I'm 46. I spent my 20s. I was very depressed in college, very anxious. I graduated. I worked in New York City in a bunch of high-pressure jobs. I worked in London in a bunch of high-pressure jobs. I ran marketing ran marketing, you know, for a big online travel company when I was in my mid-20s. You know, big high-pressure jobs. Then I went into politics. I was trying to outrun my depression and my anxiety. And as being an anxious achiever and someone who pushes herself always to succeed, the way that I did that was by moving and always seeking both a new geography and a new job. I was very career identified. And, you know, I hit like 29 and it just stopped working for me. I was overcome with a huge depression. And I quit my job. I went back to grad school and I freelanced to pay the bills. And it was when I freelanced that I had this huge aha moment, which was, I can't show up to work every day in these kinds of environments. I will never be mentally well. I will keep getting layered over, passed over, which I always was, because I just got these big jobs and then I just couldn't show up to them. And I started freelancing and then I started my own business. And I've had a couple of major depressions. I had a huge one when I was pregnant with my first son in 2008. And then I went about 13 years without a huge depression because I'm bipolar, but I have long cycling bipolar until last winter, which was really terrible. But being my own boss really gave me a lot of space and freedom and allowed me to customize around my strengths as a really anxious person and with sort of hypomania and my vulnerabilities and my weaknesses. So for me, ironically, the risk of being an entrepreneur felt much less risky than the risk of trying to fight it out in corporate America or in politics.
Wow. I'd rather do politics than go to work. That's, amazing, amazing. And through this journey and through these cycles and through these learnings and discoveries, then what was book one called again? I remember that you said it before and I was like, oh, I want to...
My first book?
What's the title? The title of the first book.
Hiding in the Bathroom. It was also
In the Bathroom. Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, brilliant. So we had that book that came out. When did you release that book?
So that book came out, the podcast started in 2015 and the book came out in 2017. Okay. And then I started my next podcast with Harvard Business Review called The Anxious Achiever. And then that just became a book.
Awesome. Look at that. Those cycling.
And then also the podcast, The Anxious Achiever, is really popular. It's actually with LinkedIn now. It's a LinkedIn Presents podcast. And, what I do on the show is basically I interview people like you, really successful people who manage mental health or neurodivergent challenges and experts, and we talk about it.
Awesome. Well, can't wait to have that conversation. But were there any foundationary points from Hiding in the Bathroom that led into the new book?
I mean, I think it was this aha moment that the anxiety piece was what people wanted to talk about. I think also when you're building a career where you are a product or a brand, I don't know about you, but it's a long process.
Oh yeah.
And you have stepping stones. And for me, hiding in the bathroom was great. It was my first, I mean, I had been writing and freelancing and blogging for years. I had been on television as an expert, so I had a little bit of a profile. But mm-hmm. hiding in the bathroom was my first sort of media brand that was my own. Mm. And the podcast was hosted by Forbes, so I had a big mm-hmm. media name behind it. And, you know, I had HarperCollins publish the book. It was like a real legitimizing moment. Mm-hmm. And then that built me credibility and an audience and a sort of niche that I was so passionate about that the anxious achiever idea just came into my head and I said, this is right. And I mm-hmm. pitched that to Harvard Business Review as a podcast. And I think that when you also are a little bit free of all the anxiety, mm-hmm. you can be really creative. And sometimes mm-hmm. the anxiety actually helps you be creative because it's forcing mm-hmm. you to take action. But I'm someone who truly believes in if you have a creative urge, if you have an idea, try it out. Maybe don't quit your day job. I mean, I was running a company through all of this. So I had by then a steady paycheck. You know, I didn't mm-hmm. make money off this stuff till recently. Mm-hmm. You know, but playing around can be really, really rewarding in so many ways.
Mm, yeah. Yummy. That feels really yummy. That feels really yummy.
So I like that. Yummy.
Yeah. Yeah. I tend to use food related adjectives in random conversation points, so get used to it. For the person who is tuning in and is like, oh, this sounds like a really, really interesting book that will probably serve me, what are some things that they can really expect to take away from the new book?
The book is really in three parts. I mean, the upfront is very much sort of establishing the idea that leaders and high-performing people feel anxiety. And leaders, mm-hmm. I use leaders very broadly. You do not have to be a CEO to read this book. You can be someone who's just, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I really introduce the concept both of being an anxious achiever, where you feel like anxiety is your oxygen, right? It drives you forward, it propels you, but it also is a drag on your mental health. There's a tension there. And that, you know, we need to talk about this stuff, that leaders have always had anxiety. Leaders have always had depression. Leaders have always been on the spectrum. There's mm-hmm. a lot of shame around it. So let's start breaking that. Then we get into sort of understanding how your anxiety shows up for you at work. We do talk a little bit about your childhood. We talk mm-hmm. about your triggers. We talk about your reactions and your bad habits from feeling anxious. And then this third half, or it's really the second half of the book, is really practical. And we go through common either kinds of anxiety, like social anxiety, mm-hmm. or traps that we get ourselves into, like feeling the need for control, like perfectionism, like feeling mm-hmm. imposter feelings, like mm-hmm. being scared to face feedback. And we talk through really practical ways that you can manage through. I mean, the book is not meant to be a replacement for therapy. I am mm-hmm. very pro-therapy. And if
Me
people
too.
Are feeling, yeah, if people really need help, like a book's not going to solve things yeah. for you.
But it can give you some direction. It can give you some points. It can bring some clarity that you can bring to the therapy sessions that's going to support you getting the
100%. Mm-hmm. And the reaction to the book has been amazing, and I think the biggest thing is that people really feel like they're not alone.
Mm. Amazing. Well, I know that you do have to run, so I'm just really grateful for the time that we have had together, and I do look forward to us talking again. If there was a final thought that you were to leave with whoever's listening to this right now to support them on their journey moving forward, apart from go and get the book, we've popped everything in the show notes. What would you leave them with today, Maura?
I mean, one of the things I would leave them with is, it sounds really cheesy, but you have to love who you are to be a great leader. Mm. And that doesn't mean being perfect. It doesn't mean being psychologically perfect. Mm. You may never cure yourself of your anxiety.
Mm-hmm. That's love okay. yourself anyway.
Manage it, do the work.
And yes, 100%. Amazing. Well, you're an absolute champion. Again, just really grateful as someone who has spent some time playing in that sandpit. I'm really grateful that you're out here being a light that's supportive to people with this what feels like a really multi-pronged, lived experience, supportive ecosystem that you create with both books, with the podcasts, and with, I'm sure, the other work that you're doing as well. So thank you. Just really grateful for you. Wanted to say thank you from all of us. Guys, make sure you go and grab both books. We'll pop both of them in the show notes. If you are a leader, if you have aspirations of being a leader, if you lead people in any way, shape, or form, and you're finding that maybe you're not handling it as well as you want, and there are sometimes you want to be in the bathroom, or that the anxiety is getting the better of you, there are two amazing podcasts and books that are a resource for you. Guys, I think Maura said it all. All I'm going to say is remember to keep dreaming with your eyes open, and that you can consciously choose a more abundant, joyful, purpose-driven life, loving yourself as you are today. Bye for now.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Do It With Dan with your host, Daniel McGenna. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit dmpotv.com. We'll catch you on the next episode of Do It With Dan.